The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, tonight's episode involves some discussion of methods of suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. Tonight, we're going to be finishing up the Jordan Eilbert story, Restoration. I'll give a brief recap of the prior segment if you haven't listened to last week's episode, but first, I need to make an announcement about the show. For those of you listening on YouTube, you might have noticed that last week's episode was delayed. We're going to be reducing our focus on YouTube content moving forward, so I'd recommend listening on the podcast app of your choice, such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. We're going to be continuing with video content over on Rumble, and of course, you always have the option to become a patron and help support the show. All this is to say that, if YouTube is your main vehicle for Chilling Tales for Dark Nights content, it's probably time to shift over to another delivery platform. Anyway, on to tonight's story. Last week, we met Fred, a restoration expert that got handed a very lucrative and very strange job. Fred and his team set out to remove bloodstains from a large and quite ancient marble building. The man that hired him, Timothy, is an odd duck that seems to know more about the situation than he's letting on. In the process of cleaning the place up, Fred inadvertently found a large chunk of blood that had solidified into a sort of amber after being trapped in a gash on the floor. Now, a supernatural entity calling itself Belial has shown up at Fred's house, demanding the amber in exchange for his family's safety. Fred has just driven back to the job site in the dead of night to retrieve the amber, but the building is different. And the amber is, of course, gone. What will Belial do to Fred's family if he can't deliver? What was the strange vial of liquid that Timothy gave Fred to protect him from Belial? And why is Fred's Honduran worker, Chavez, now able to speak fluent English? Find out tonight on Horror Hill. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Jordan Eilbert, I give you Restoration, Part 2. Part 4. I was panicked. I wasn't even sure what to do. Timothy was a don't-ask customer, so I had no contact info saved, no way to reach him, not even a cell number. That's when I realized I did have some hope. I got back into the truck and hauled ass to my office. I could get there in about 20 minutes, I could check the caller ID, and maybe reach him that way. I zipped out of the long driveway and got moving as fast as possible, leaving the gate open. I don't even think I closed the doors to the old mansion. I got to the office in just under 15 minutes. I fumbled with the lock, having to stop myself for a second and then calmly get the key into the slot. I pulled the door open and rushed over to my desk. I hit the call history on the phone, and I finally got a number. Out of state, sure, it was from New York, which was fine, and probably the right number. I hit the speed redial while jotting the number down. My stomach dropped when it went directly to voicemail, and I heard the message on the other end. "You've reached Major Timothy Crestfall. Please leave a message, and I'll get back to you shortly. Godspeed." I hadn't caught my breath by the time the beep occurred. "Timothy, please, you need to call me back. Belial's threatening my family, my wife, the kids. I gave them that water you gave me, but this guy, he's... I don't think..." Should I say it out loud to make it real? "I don't think he's human. Help me." I hung up and tried to call again, direct to voicemail once more. A random thought runs past my frantic mind. He's a bit young looking for an officer, right? My cell phone rings. It's a 1-800 number of some sort, calling me in the middle of the night. I was about to ignore it, but something told me I shouldn't. I answer the phone. "This is Fred. Who is this?" There's a crackle on the other line. I think I hear something like a scream before it cuts out entirely. A young man is on the line, and he sounds shaken. "Sir, are you Mr. Fred Massione?" "Yes, who is this?" "This is your home alarm central monitoring. Sir, we're getting alerts that multiple smoke detectors have alarmed in the home. We've contacted the fire department, but we're not able to reach anyone in the house via the front panel. Are you home at the moment?" I feel a little dizzy, but I stand up regardless and make my way to my car. "Oh, God, have you tried my wife's cell?" "Yes, sir, we've attempted multiple times. Are you home?" No, I'm not home." "The fire department is on the way, sir. Do you need me to stay on the line with you?" "No, I'm going home." I jump out of the office, leaving it unlocked, and I get in the truck. At this point, I don't give a single solitary fuck about speed limits. I'm flooring it. I'm not even paying attention to the speedometer until I look in my rear view and I see police lights. I pull over, shaking, not even sure what's going on, what's happening with my family. I keep thinking that they're going to be safe, that I gave that holy water stuff to them and they have to be alive and well because of that. Chavez called it God's blessing. A tap against my window and I roll it down quickly. The cop is a gruff-looking, heavy-set black guy. "In a hurry?" My voice cracks and I try to compose myself. "Officer, I got a message from my alarm company that there are smoke alarms going off at my house. I've got about 20 minutes to get there. I need a pass on this." The officer puts his hand out. "License, sir." I curse and hand him my license, and I hear him actually running to his car. I contemplate just speeding off right then and there, scenarios going through my head of him shooting out my tires or turning the entire thing into a police chase. My train of thought is broken when he runs back to my window, giving me my license.
"Follow me. Try to keep up, sir."
"What?" I'm confused by this.
"I'm giving you an escort."
I think I went pale at this point. The cop puts his hand on my shoulder.
"Sir, do you need me to give you a lift?"
I look to my shaking hands and just nod dumbly. He opens my truck door, takes out the keys, and undoes the seatbelt. Before I know what's going on, I'm in his squad car, and we're speeding down the streets with the sirens blaring. I hear the radio chatter come in and out, but I can barely understand it. He grabs his radio.
"Car 314, I've got the resident of 335 Locust Street, en route to the scene."
The scene? I'm still in disbelief, shock, and can barely tell when we're on my street and the car finally slows down after it was done running every red light and every stop sign. The car comes to a stop, and I scramble out of the car.
I'm half blinded by the sea of emergency vehicles, ambulances, fire, other cop cars. I think briefly that at least the alarm system did something after 10 years of a monthly subscription. The heavyset officer is already out and parting the onlookers in front of me, stepping past the caution tape. He says something to the other officers as I wander onto my front lawn. I stagger onto the lawn to see the smoldering remains of my home. Firefighters are working to put one of the fires out. I look around frantically, trying to spot Sandy and the boys. And I eventually find them. Three body bags are on the lawn, sealed. Two smaller forms inside, and another that reminds me of my wife when she would hide under the sheets. I feel pain in my knees suddenly. Apparently, I fell at seeing them. I feel a pair of hands on my shoulders, another roughly handling my arms and hefting me up. My legs barely function as I'm led to the back of an ambulance. The heavyset officer helps me sit down in the back of the ambulance. Through all the white noise, I see a very bright light in my face, and a voice slowly, finally, comes through. "Can you hear me, sir?" A young black woman is in front of me with an ophthalmoscope. I blink, finally, shaking my head. "Yeah." She moves the bright light back and forth, and I start to come out of my funk. I look to the pavement. "They didn't make it out, did they?" Her tone is empathetic, but practiced. "I'm sorry, no. We did everything we could, but by the time the fire department was even able to reach them, it was too late." I do my best not to just burst into tears, but they come anyway. I suppress a sob and try to swallow it down. I blink a few tears out of my eyes, and I hear the female EMT walk away. I hear a few male voices approaching. "This him? Okay. I've got it from here. You can fall back. Like it ugly, you know." I shake my head, knocking a few tears out. Cops are going to be asking me questions, and I need to be composed. I try to dry my eyes, but it doesn't work. I feel the ambulance shift slightly as someone sits next to me. "Mr. Massione?" I nod, eyes still downcast. "I'm Detective Benjamin Leibel. I've got a few questions to ask, mostly regarding your whereabouts prior to the fire. Smoke?" A pack of cigarettes is offered. I take one, accept the light, and take a deep breath. I'm about to say something when I think about how odd that name sounds. I hear a wheezing snicker, and the voice changes to one I'm far too familiar with. "I'm kidding, Freddy. I know where you were." My head snaps to the left, and I see Belial. He's sitting right next to me, black hair slicked back above his pale face, yellow eyes, and two white teeth. His duster is still white, but in addition to the red tie, he has a police ID badge hanging around his neck. I clench my fist, grit my teeth, but before I can stand and deck him in his perfect teeth, his hand is on my fist, and he's hushing me, pulling my hand down. "Shush," he starts. "I was just delivering on a promise, Red Fred." I try to push against his hand, but it doesn't budge. "Stop calling me that." "We all call you that, Red Fred. You should get used to it." His grin fades. "But I have to give you some kudos, Freddy. That was a dirty trick." "What the hell are you talking about?" His grin seems to return somewhat. "When I couldn't pull you towards me, I assumed you had drunk some of the sanctified water from the Guardian Temple."
"Guardian Temple?"
Belial snickers, almost hissing.
"The place you were cleaning, Freddy."
He takes a deep breath, wheezing out his next words.
"As I said, you surprised me, giving your only protection against me to your family. Smarter than I took you for."
I glare daggers at him, even with tears in my eyes.
This seems to make him even happier. You see, Fred, normally what I would have done would have been to march up to your children's bedroom, wake them up, and then take them to Mommy. I'd then torture her relentlessly until she forsakes you and the children, and then promise her an end to her pain in exchange for her soul. A chill runs down my spine. The strong ones resist, right up until I threaten to put the children through the same pain I'm putting her through. He's grinning a sick grin from ear to ear. Then I take her soul in exchange for the safety of her children. Once that's mine, I remove the love she holds for her family, for God, make her one of my whores, and then she usually would just kill the kids on her own. He lights his own cigarette. You know, for fun. I can feel the horror just wash over me. It's almost without fail worked for at least 9 out of 10. I try to swallow the lump in my throat. But you, Fred, his grin fades. You robbed me of a good time. You see, normally, if you drink a half bottle of that holy water, you're protected from possession and the like. But what you did, Fred, giving them your protection selflessly, that bumped the potency up something fierce. He shows me his left hand, the skin on his palm almost entirely black, his hand shriveled and shaking. One of his rings even falls off his finger and shatters when it hit the ground. He curses in some unknown guttural language as this happens. You see, Fred, that happened when I reached out and grabbed your wife's arm. Burned like a bitch. Still feel it burning, actually. He now glares at me. The yellow in his eyes seems to be moving. So, with me being unable to touch them, I had to take some more mundane methods of keeping my promise. He pulls his hand away and slides the leather glove over it. Broke the doorknobs, nailed a few windows down, made sure they didn't get out as I burned the place down, bottom to top. He snickers. You protected your family from me, but the house was a different story. I'm gritting my teeth, staring daggers at Belial, as he seems to be enjoying telling me all of this. His tone changes, however. I've never had to end someone like that. It was so mundane, so dull, and knowing that their souls were saved as I did it. Smoke spews from his nostrils as he huffs and wheezes again. What nasty taste to leave in my mouth, Fred. He stands. But you've been through enough today. I'll let you live, for now. Belial turns to me. Unless you want to make it easier on everyone and just, you know. He slides a finger across his throat. Might be nice to do something ironic, you know. There's a tire swing in the backyard. Could hang yourself from it. As he speaks, I feel kind of woozy and confused. Maybe at the motel, take the hairdryer and take a shower with it. I shake my head. It feels like someone's shoving cotton in my ears, and I can only hear his voice over the background noises. His breath is on my ear now. When you think about it, what sort of man can't even protect his family? The only honorable way out is to remove yourself from the equation. Suddenly, he's gone, and I can think clearly again. The EMT is back, and she starts taking my vitals. I'm gazing up at the night sky, and I've got no idea what I'm going to do. The next week goes by like I'm a passenger in my body. I work out details with funeral directors and lawyers and insurance companies. I get tired of hearing the words, "Sorry for your loss."
I'm bouncing between absolute sorrow and blinding anger, and I can't control which family members I snap at or sob in front of.
By the time the funeral day comes, it's me and a few friends and family on my wife's side. I'm in a church, the first time in years, and the organ is playing a sad old dirge while I sit at one of the front pews, alone. My family wants little to do with me. Half of them think I burned the house down in a triple homicide. The news was leaked somehow, about how the windows were nailed shut and the doorknobs were removed before being locked. So I'm pretty shocked when someone in a rather nice suit and some pretty powerful cologne sits next to me.
"We only just heard," a pretty thick Latin accent chimes in, but a pretty familiar one.
I look up to see Chavez, of all people, sitting next to me. He's wearing a pretty expensive tailored suit, too.
"Chavez?"
He points to a necklace of some kind around his neck.
"Temple charm. Helps you understand me, even when we're outside of it."
I sit up, looking him over, extremely confused.
"Why are you here?"
I narrow my eyes.
"And where the fuck is Timothy?"
Chavez frowns.
"He's here, but I told him not to come to you yet. I know you blame him for this."
"No shit, Chavez." I look around the church before Chavez puts his hand on my shoulder.
"Where is he?"
Chavez shakes his head.
"Now isn't the time, Fred."
I now glare at Chavez.
"So what? You're his lackey now?"
I stare ahead at the three caskets, all closed, before me.
"What the hell is he?"
"Not what we both thought," is all Chavez says. We're both quiet for some time before Chavez decides to piss me off.
"I know how you feel."
"Fuck you, Chavez." I glare at him. I'm out of tears at this point. I'm just in an angry mood right now.
"You know how I feel? Sandy and the boys didn't deserve this. She was an amazing woman. The boys were great kids. They didn't deserve this. And it's because of me getting mixed up with Timothy's bullshit temple or whatever it was. So don't give me the I know how you feel nonsense. You don't have a fucking clue."
Chavez is silent as he looks ahead at the caskets.
"When I was in Honduras, I helped the cartels smuggle drugs past the border. I would build chairs, tables, and the like. They'd hide the coke in them, and I made the trap doors. But one day, my trap doors all started to get found out. One day, the cartel comes to me, and they tell me that they're going to try something new. They want me to make crucifixes and hide the drugs there. They tell me the drugs won't be found as easy because people won't check the crucifixes."
He makes a sign of the cross over his heart.
"I refuse. I tell them I'm going to leave. I promise not to tell the police, but I tell them I'm done."
He turns to me, hands now clasped in his lap.
"The next day, I wake up with a bag on my head, and I think they're going to kill me, you know. I make my peace with God and accept my fate. They bring me to a river. Along with it, they have my mother, father, wife, my daughter, all lined up."
His normally happy face turns mournful.
"They don't even give me a choice. They execute my family in front of me, throw them into the river. They tell me, you live for the cartel, or you die for the cartel."
I just look away at this point. Chavez leans back in the pew, now looking to me.
"You get to bury your family, Fred. Be happy for that. I'll never have that right. It was taken from me."
I turn to him. His story is probably worse than my own, not that I'm weighing tragedies or anything.
"Chavez," I ask, "you never answered me. Why are you even here right now?"
Chavez looks around as if searching for someone.
"Fred, you always helped me out. You gave me a job, gave me a ride to my place when I needed it. Chavez gives me a sympathetic smile. I'm here because I'm your friend. As a man, I usually leave crying for the macho stuff, Grand Canyon and funerals. I guess this was an exception, though. Of all the people who would show up when I needed them, if you told me it would be Jorge Chavez, the illegal immigrant who's the best guy I know with the sandblaster, I'd never have believed you. Now I'm sobbing next to the guy, and he's doing his best to comfort me. Chavez even volunteers to be a pallbearer at the end of the ceremony. At the graveyard, he is the last one to stand with me. I turn to him as I'm still swinging between deep depression and seething anger. Chavez, how can you still believe in God? He took everything from you, and yet you're still faithful? Chavez starts to unbutton his jacket as he talks. When the cartel killed my family, they forced me to be their runner. He undoes his jacket and now is undoing some buttons on his shirt. One day, during a drop, I see a hole in the border fence to America. I think to myself, I can live in the cartel or die free. I prayed to God and asked him to protect me during my escape. I ran. He reveals his chest. There's a hole just below his ribcage on the right. It looks like a bullet wound. It missed my heart, lungs, and didn't even hit bone. A one in a million shot. A miracle, Fred. God's protection. That's why we should thank him every day, he says while tapping the scar. Thank him? Chavez, where was he when Sandy and the boys needed help? Where was God? Why didn't he help them then? Chavez looks me dead in the eyes as he buttons up his shirt. Did you ask him to help, Fred? I'm silent and just stare ahead of me past the graves. It can't possibly be that simple, I tell myself. That whole ask and you shall receive nonsense. After a while, Chavez leaves my side. A few minutes later, I hear someone walking up behind me. I look, still facing ahead, and see Timothy in a black trench coat and suit with black tie behind me. You've got balls, man, I say curtly. I never intended for this, Timothy says plainly. He looks over the graves. What you did to protect them was, well, it was beyond what I thought you could do. He had started to smile a bit, but now his smile fades. If I had known you had a family, I'd have given you some other tools. I turn and march right up to him. Despite this, he doesn't flinch as I get in his face. Yeah, your tools were really fucking useful. I gave my wife and the boys that sacred water and it just gave them a quicker death. It saved their souls, Fred, Timothy says simply. Because of you, your wife's soul isn't in the possession of Belial. Neither are your children. Bullshit, I shout. That's not how that shit works. You don't lose your soul if a demon possesses you. Sometimes you die, but I know enough about that shit to know you're just bullshitting me. I talked to the fucking priests. You think Belial is a demon? I take a step back. What else would he be? Timothy's face doesn't change expression in the least. Belial was first a dark angel, long ago. He was tasked with punishing impure souls. That was before the war. Timothy looks to the sky. I look up with him. What war? The war of the cherubim and seraphim. The cherubim were high-order angels created by God to be his servants, but who aligned themselves with Lucifer. Timothy looks to me. The war began when Belial talked Lucifer into defying God in the first place. I'm pretty dumbfounded at this point and look to the graves of my family for a moment. Why does such a big shot from down below want to fuck with me then? The amber you spoke of, it has enormous power. Power enough where, if Belial got his hands on it, he'd be able to pull himself into this world. Timothy answers. Pull himself. Newsflash, Timothy. He's already here. Timothy shakes his head slowly. Belial is only possessing a man now. That's why the first day he didn't just kill you and take the amber. The man he had possessed was still resisting him, still fighting. At that stage of early possession, a spirit cannot make someone do something they do not wish to. It wasn't until the next day his will faltered and Belial gained full control. Still, even in full control, only a wisp of his power can get through that vessel. Timothy gives me an odd smile. Belial, with the amber, would have brought himself into this world completely, and as a full-powered cherubim, laid waste to everything. Now he beamed at me. So, Fred, you saved the world by keeping it from him. I look away from Timothy, not knowing how to feel about that. It only cost my family's lives. Their souls are safe. And Belial's still out there. He's still going to fuck with me, isn't he? I imagine he's none too pleased that you protected your family from him. He'll likely continue to torment you. Plan on doing anything about it? I glare at the graves. Or am I going to get a spot next to Sandy here as my protection? Do you plan on asking? I turn and face him. Please, Timothy, fucking help me get rid of this thing. Don't ask me. Timothy turns away from me and starts walking away. Who the hell do I ask then? I shout. Timothy ignores me and continues to walk away. I turn to face the graves again, and I get the hint. I look around and clear my throat. Hey, God, mind giving me a hand here? Chavez's hand is on my shoulder suddenly. Do you know how to ask, Fred? I shake my head and Chavez just smiles. I'll show you. He gets on his knees and starts. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. I slowly get to my knees and repeat. Chavez whispers next to me, Now ask and end with Amen. Chavez then gets up and leaves. I'm still on my knees, feeling rather awkward, but I just continue. God, I know I'm kind of a stranger these days, but I need help. This Belial guy, he's killed my family, and I need justice. Help me get rid of him. I hope that's enough, and finish. Amen. Suddenly, I hear a deep voice above me. Fred Massione. I look up, seeing only the silhouette of a male figure above me. God? I'm suddenly pulled up onto my feet, and I see several officers, as well as the detective who said my name. The guy looks like an off-season weightlifter who's been shoved into a detective's uniform. The black officer's head is bald, and his voice is deeper than I'm used to hearing. Never been called God before, but for you, I may as well be. You're under arrest for suspected murder, arson, and conspiracy to commit insurance fraud. Great, I say out loud as they cuff me. Hey, watch it! As I'm led away from the graves of my family, I spot him, clad in his usual white duster and red tie, wearing the police badge again. The black detective yells at him, Hey, Ben, we got our caller. You were right, he did hang around here longer than everyone else. Belial smiles as he greets his fellow officer. Good work, then. He speaks in his false human voice. Didn't think he'd be hard. He left a shitload of evidence behind. He smiles at me. We're going to have fun with you. Thanks, God, I think to myself as I'm shoved into a squad car. I look out the window as I see the black detective walk away from Belial, and then Timothy comes out from behind a tree nearby. Timothy stares Belial down, and Belial turns to face him. They contrast each other oddly, Timothy in his black trench coat and Belial in white. Not the right matchup, I think. They say a few things to each other, though I can't really hear too well. "Leave," is what I can make out from Timothy. Belial seems to laugh, but I can't hear what he's saying. Watching his lips, it looks like he says, "Mother," at some point. Timothy seems to narrow his eyes and get serious. "Kick his ass, Timothy," I think to myself as I watch with bated breath as the two square off in the graveyard. Timothy seems calm and collected. Belial is grinning ear to ear. I look back and forth between the two, and my heart skipped a beat at what happened next. Belial makes a sudden step towards Timothy in a rapid jerking motion, and then falls back to where he was. Timothy flinches, causing Belial to laugh, before turning away and walking back to an unmarked car with the other detective. "Oh, great," I think to myself. "My guardian angel is a pussy."
Part 5. I get pulled out of the squad car in my Sunday best and led into the police station. Fingerprinted? Great. Mugshot? Awesome. Pat down? Man, this day's going great. I started off burying my family, only to get arrested for their murders in the evening. The pat-down is a bit odd. The officer who's doing it stops at my coat pocket, doesn't pull anything out, and just waves me by after removing my wallet. I'm finally plopped into an interview room. There's a little two-way mirror, about 2 feet square, a table, and 3 chairs, counting mine. I notice they're bolted down, which makes sense, as I'm sure they don't want folks going full Jerry Springer when being interrogated. I try to contemplate how I wound up here, thinking about where everything has been going and how. I think of a way I can maybe convince the detective who arrested me that his partner isn't who he seems. Could that work? I think of scenarios where, if he was convinced, what would happen? I know Belial can move objects. I saw that firsthand. Something tells me if I had not been handling highly sacred objects, he'd have been able to pull me too. If I blow his cover, will he just kill us and everyone in this place? Or worse, will he kill his partner, a la Darth Vader force choke, and spin another frame job on me? Should I even count Belial as a he, or should I just be using it? Despite all this, I'm feeling oddly calm when I see both of them walk into the room. The black detective sits down and clicks on a recording device which is embedded in the wall.
"So, Mr. Massione, I'm Detective Aaron Brown. We just want to ask a few questions and then we can all go about our day."
I look to Belial, who's letting his partner do the talking for now. "I'll be happy to answer them, but I'll say this much. I didn't murder my family." Detective Brown just nods and smiles.
"Of course."
He looks down to a file folder, pulling out a piece of paper.
"So, the day of the events concerning your family's tragic demise, where were you?"
Belial is smiling wickedly. "I was visiting a work site and then my office. I was looking for some equipment I'd left behind," I say plainly. I'm not entirely lying, after all.
"This work site, how far away from your house was it?"
Detective Brown continues.
"About an hour,"
I say simply.
"And why, in the middle of the night, did you feel the need to check for this equipment? Why couldn't it wait till morning?"
I did not have a decent answer for this, and I tried to think of something that wouldn't immediately put both Belial and Detective Brown at immediate odds with me. I wanted to try and survive this interview without being in jail, which seemed unlikely at this point. "Well, your demon-possessed partner over there sent me off to get an unholy object or else he was going to slaughter my entire family. While truthful, probably would make him think I'm fucking around with him." Despite that being the truth, I decided to try to stick to my lie. "I was afraid it might get stolen. It was pretty expensive."
"Well, that makes sense. What piece of equipment was it, if you don't mind me asking?"
Of all the cops in the world, I get the one competent bastard that can smell bullshit from a mile away, don't I? Remember, folks, Get your lie straight before you're in the hot seat.
It was a sandblaster, fairly large one.
At least a couple grand for that, right? Wouldn't look too good on the old expense report if it went missing,
the very accurate detective asks.
I nod, and I have a good idea where he's going with this line of questioning, but I'm hoping we don't get there.
This job was on Monday and Tuesday about 2 weeks ago, right?
I nod.
That's very interesting.
Belial now interjects.
Why is that interesting, Aaron?
Detective Brown looks to me now.
Feel free to explain why I find that interesting, Mr. Massione.
Because my schedule at the office doesn't say I had a job that day, I admit, hoping some honesty can be appreciated.
The detective bangs his pen on the table 3 times.
We have a winner.
He leans over to me, getting uncomfortably close over the table.
Your usual crew also doesn't say you had a job.
I say what I'm about to say, knowing I'm going to start treading some deep water. There was a job, but the client preferred to be non-public.
Non-public? Detective Brown's playful smile fades quickly. You know, every time I get a prick like you, one of these, I can't be culpable if I don't know what happened, assholes. You always have another word for it. Confidential, on the down low, under the table, discreet, exclusive, but non-public. Well, that's a nice way of putting, my client is probably dealing with some criminal shit I don't want to know about.
The detective leans back in his chair.
What do you say, Mr. Massione? Am I in the ballpark?
I'm quiet now, waiting. I glance to Belial and catch his shit-eating grin. I'm starting to sweat, and there's nothing I can do to stop myself.
We had some forensic accounting done on your business, Mr. Massione. Pretty preliminary stuff, you know.
He leans over toward Belial.
It should have gone under about a year ago. Or, at the very least, you should have fired someone.
Belial now interjects. Now, dealing a few jobs under the table here and there isn't a big deal, but...
$100,000? That's a shitload extra stuffed into your accounts, Detective Brown says slyly.
I look to Belial. That's not how much I have in my business, at least not in the bank. Timothy's case was the biggest score I had in months, and this year the under-the-table stuff didn't come close to making up the difference, not between all the expenses, equipment, and so on I had to pay.
Did Belial do something?
I literally have no idea what you're talking about.
So you don't know where payment of over 30 grand came from in the past month? Say, the cash we found in an envelope with a thank you letter that wasn't on your books but was definitely a payment? Such a nice letter, too. Must have done him a hell of a favor.
Admittedly, he had me there. With everything going the way it was, I never had time to properly handle the cash I got from Timothy's job. Normally, I'd make sure to pay out a bonus or two, buy some equipment, pay off some bills, and always do it with the under-the-table cash. I suddenly had an epiphany, because maybe Belial didn't do anything but crunch the numbers of what I had done that year. I did have 2 cleanups, but they weren't as high profile, but they did overpay. I'm sweating more as I think about whether or not I'm a good person after all. Here I am, thinking about how my money laundering didn't go over so well, and I think the average kid dealing weed on the street corner could do a better job.
That accounts for this year alone, and our guys are sifting through your books as we speak, and we keep on finding gaps and payments and bills paid that never should be paid.
Detective Brown cracks his knuckles.
And somehow, I do not think your non-public clients would appreciate us digging through their dirty laundry. Might get ugly for you, especially if you're on the outside.
That's the stick. Now this guy's going to give me a carrot.
Of course, we could just skip all that, if you can tell me, honestly, what happened to your wife and kids, why the doorknobs were found removed, and why the windows were nailed shut.
I'm quiet while I think of a way out, but then I hear Belial's human voice.
Aaron, why don't you step out, have a coffee? I'll turn that thing off and I'll have a word or two with him.
Detective Brown looks to Belial.
Ben, he clicks off the recorder. I can't have another charge against you for roughing someone up during interrogation.
Belial just nods. It's okay, Aaron. Just step out for a second. It'll be fine.
Detective Brown stands up and leaves the room.
I'm pretty sure about half of all of that was normal good cop, bad cop setup. But with Belial alone with me in the room, I'm pretty sure I got the good cop, satanic cop game played on me.
Belial wheezes in his normal voice.
That was dull and boring, wasn't it?
He leans back in his chair.
Do they still do the chair here, or just lethal injection?
I narrow my eyes on him.
Lethal injection is fun. A lot can go wrong.
Belial's eyes are on me as he leans back, grinning.
You can feel your heart and your lungs start to shut down sometimes.
I adjust myself nervously in my seat and suddenly feel something in my jacket pocket.
My hand discreetly checks it while Belial leans back in his seat, looking to the ceiling lights. It's round, cold, and I feel a cap. I try to hide my excitement. It's the same type of bottle that Sandy and the kids drank. I wondered what it would do if I doused him in it. I also wonder how it even got into my pocket, but I'm much more concerned with what to do now that it's here.
You know, beheadings were technically more painless.
He looks me in the eyes now.
I miss beheadings.
He moves his now healed left hand up to his temple, resting his head on his hand. I notice he's only sporting three of his black rings, and I remember how one crumbled away from touching my wife.
Hangings, too. Nothing beats when the rope doesn't snap the neck, and you're just left being strangled by the rope, all while you piss and shit yourself in front of a crowd.
Now or never, I think, as I thumb the cap off the bottle in my pocket.
Shut up.
Belial's gaze shifts slightly.
What if I don't, Red Fred?
I remember what my mother used to say whenever she felt she was dealing with things possessed in the house. Normally it was a dryer on the fritz or a bird that somehow managed to get into the house, but the phrase rang pretty clearly in my head for some reason, the second the bottle was opened in my pocket. I hoped I wasn't going to look like a complete moron if this didn't work. I splashed the contents of the bottle on his hand first, then his face. I made sure to get every one of those rings covered in the water, too. While I did this, I shouted, "In the name of Jesus Christ, get thee behind me!"
Steam erupted from his rings, and he gasped suddenly in intense pain. He chokes as he inhales the rising steam from his hand. He stands up quickly and presses himself against the wall, and he starts to flail as if he can't breathe. I kept splashing him and got a bit on myself in the process. I was a bit frantic at this point. I remember every time I saw an exorcism flick and started chanting, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, leave this man," interjected with a few, "The power of Christ compels you." If not for the apparently seizing man across from me, I likely looked ridiculous. Belial is wheezing, hacking, and coughing. His rings have broken and crumbled to the ground. I feel like I'm missing something serious in all this because he's still in front of me, his yellow eyes swirling and glaring at me. I can almost hear his voice in my head as if it's saying,
"When this wears off, I'm going to murder you."
I'm pretty sure I'm just pissing him off right now, but he's definitely weakened.
I look to the bottle and I notice something is written on it. Is it a parable?
I splash Belial one more time and read the bottle. Then I give my own shit-eating grin to Belial and read the writing out loud.
"Most glorious Prince of Presence, Saint Enoch, the knower of secrets, heavenly scribe, the governor of the world, expel from this cursed flesh the fallen before me."
After the words leave my lips, I feel dizzy. I'm not sure if that's because I just might have successfully cast out an all-powerful demon prince, or because I'm being tackled by Detective Brown. Either way, when I hit the floor, I'm completely winded and not sure if I can keep chanting.
"What the fuck did you just do to my partner?"
Detective Brown shouts. From his point of view, things have gone far too south, far too quickly. Maybe he just got a coffee and came back to see his partner being dosed in what looked like acid from the outside. Both of us are distracted, however, as the screams coming from Belial change pitch. Suddenly, they go higher, shrieking, and I watch his mouth open unnaturally wide as his head points upward, his back arching unnaturally, arms stiffening to his sides as he begins to shake. The form of a man crawls out of his opened mouth, naked from the waist up. His eyes are yellow and black swirls of smoke, his form translucent. His brow is furrowed as long black hair seems to float over him as if he's underwater. His face, his body, his arms, hands, every part of him looks physically perfect, as if some male fitness model just appeared out of this guy's mouth. His form grows. It fills the room, moving over the ceiling as I notice a pair of black wings appear to be on either side of him. They look like black flames. The flames rising from each wing seem to make the room hotter, and ash falls from the bottom of each. The wings are so large they fill the entire room and block off the exit. I'm suddenly hit with a strong scent of sulfur, and the shrieking from the physical body of Benjamin grows louder. Belial's left hand reaches out toward me, his teeth gritted.
"Fred,"
his voice hisses louder than I had ever heard it before, no longer a wheeze, a vile breath reaching me and making me retch.
"Not by you, you pathetic, sinful mortal,"
he yells, his voice bellowing and shaking the room.
"I will not be cast out by the likes of you."
The room shakes even more, and his hand almost touches me. His finger appears to turn to smoke, and his hand grabs his chest, his wings wrapped around himself. Above him, there's a more terrifying sight. A spear pierces through him from above, again translucent. A massive hand holds the spear. The hand is black, clawed, and seems to be scaled like a lizard. A giant lizard head pushes down from the ceiling, white glowing eyes drowning out the light of the fluorescent bulbs in the room, and more contrasting black scales along its muzzle. I can make out a pair of horns near the back of its head, but they disappear into the ceiling. I hear an unearthly roar as the spear is pulled back and then thrust through Belial again, hitting him in the chest, right into where I assume a heart would be if the bastard had one. Belial screams once more. His voice shakes me to my core.
"No, no, do not send me back."
At his last words, suddenly, nothing but a black ball hovers over the mouth of Belial's previous host. I see the black lizard's face open its maw, and a white light douses the little ball over Belial's former body. Suddenly, all the air seems to be sucked out of the room, and I feel a massive pressure smash into me and knock me and the detective into the far wall as the black ball seemed to explode in bright white light. I hear nothing but ringing in my ears, and right after, I hear glass shattering and the sounds of alarms blaring. Someone grabs me, hauling me out of the room. As I'm being shuffled out, dust and chaos all around me, I see Belial's body lying motionless on the floor, his partner shouting something or other to other officers. The officer who has me keeps pulling me and roughly handling me. I feel weak, and I shield my eyes as I'm suddenly outside, then thrown into the back of a car. My ears barely stop ringing, and I think I have myself composed enough until the car starts up, speeding off, sirens blaring. I hear a Latin accent again from the front seat. That was amazing, Fred! Good job!
I look up and see Chavez, wearing a police cap and uniform, giving me thumbs up. Right before I pass out, I realize that the cop who gave me the pat-down must have been Chavez. He put the water into my pocket. I chuckle as I lose consciousness. I'm woken up by a knocking on the rear window. I groggily look up to see Chavez's smiling face on the other side, now without the policeman's cap on.
Fred, wake up, man, let's go!
The door opens and I'm dragged out. Chavez gets me to my feet, but I feel weak and I can barely walk.
You did great, Fred, you did! Hang on a little bit longer.
I can't go on and fall to my knees. Everything is still spinning.
St. Timothy! Chavez shouts. Quickly!
Before I know what's going on, I see Timothy rushing towards me.
You have to heal his spirit, Chavez says. The exorcism took a toll on him.
Jorge, I don't know how, I hear Timothy admit. Chavez grabs Timothy's hand and places it on my forehead.
Ask your grandmother.
Timothy then takes a breath, and suddenly I feel, well, better. I blink my eyes clear and start to get up off my knees. By the time I'm standing, I look to Timothy in front of me, still wearing his trench coat, looking at his hand curiously. Chavez is thrilled.
I told you, Belial's interference wasn't enough to weaken the gift passed on.
Timothy nods, seemingly in shock, and then looks to me.
You did well, Fred.
I lean up against the car and look Timothy in the eyes.
So you're not an angel.
Timothy shakes his head, but Chavez protests.
He is,
Chavez smiles to me.
But he's still young. He doesn't know his own strength, Fred.
I look to Chavez oddly.
How do you know?
Because I read, Fred. I read the Bible.
He points to Timothy.
He's the grandson of Saint Dinah, daughter of Enoch.
Timothy just nods.
We can talk later, Chavez. I think Fred needs to know where he is.
Chavez smiles and points to a two-story house.
That's your new home.
I look around. There seem to be a few homes sprinkled here and there, but it looks like I'm in the middle of Midwestern bumfuck nowhere. Timothy and Chavez make their way down the walkway toward the two-story home, and I follow. When Timothy gets to the door, he knocks three times.
Fred's here,
Timothy says as he knocks. The door opens, and I see Sandy's smiling face.
I run past Chavez and Timothy, and I hug and kiss her for what feels like too short a time,
right up until I get a firm punch to the shoulder. Timothy and Chavez both wince.
Never take a job like this again, she says. We were scared half to death.
She takes a deep breath.
Also, we're going to start going to church. Like, a lot.
I thought you were dead. You and the boys,
I said softly. Suddenly, Sandy is glaring at Timothy.
Oh, did you?
She charges at Timothy and proceeds to hammer his shoulder a few times, punctuating each hit with a word.
Timothy, how dare you do that to him?
Timothy gasps in pain.
I'm sorry, Sandy.
She turns around sharply and walks back inside.
The boys are playing video games right now, and they won't shut up about how the internet sucks. Now get in here while I try to figure out dinner.
I hear a litany of other complaints from her, from the stove to the refrigerator and the like, which is typical of her. I walk inside, relieved to find my wife safe and still slightly crazy, and greet my two boys. For the first time in weeks, I feel happy and free. After dinner, where my boys challenge Chavez to a round of some first-person shooter, I see Timothy in the backyard looking out over more than an acre of property, apparently mine, the sun setting in the distance.
I walk toward him, looking him over.
So, how old are you?
25, Timothy says.
Jesus, I have 15 years on you, I say plainly. Timothy nods.
How exactly are you an angel? Timothy shakes his head.
I'm hardly an angel. Certainly not a saint like Jorge keeps calling me.
So what are you then?
At best, half angel, half...
He looks far away into the sky.
Monster.
Care to elaborate? I'm done being in the dark.
So, we're breaking the no-questions-asked policy?
He smiles as he turns to me. I nod. Yes, because I won't be doing that anymore. I shudder. I was worried enough about the cops finding out what I did, but... I take a deep breath.
I guess I didn't realize what else was just as interested.
Timothy just chuckles.
To answer your question, I'm the grandson of Dinah of Enoch, who is the daughter of Enoch, of course, known as the Metatron, the voice of God.
Enoch, that's the guy I shouted about in front of Belial. Timothy nods.
Most exorcisms don't go that well. Part one is getting the name of the spirit infesting the body. Part two is ensuring you have the correct angel to get the job done. Most possessions, you can invoke Michael the Archangel and they'll go screaming because Michael's the commander of God's army. Half the time, Michael will actually delegate the task to a lesser angel, but that depends on the individual's faith and resolve. That can drive out most lesser demons. For Belial, we needed bigger guns, but a stronger resolve. That's why we needed you, seeking justice and retribution. Otherwise, you may have died.
Timothy frowned to me.
It's why I had to make you believe Belial had killed your family. It was hard, as I can't lie.
I try to let that not sink in. So, you can't lie at all?
As a descendant of Enoch, it's kind of in my blood. I mean, someone who speaks for God has to lack the ability to lie, of course.
I try to think of a time when Timothy lied to me, but while he did withhold information, he never did lie. My family's souls were safe, that was true, and he didn't even lie about the blood or how long it was there. Also explains why he was shit at haggling.
That means you talk to God? The Metatron speaks for God, right?
Timothy sighs and shakes his head.
My mother was stolen from Dinah when she was a child, stolen by none other than Belial. He corrupted her, filled her with hatred and despair. She had me with a, let's just say, a mass murderer, a fallen prophet, one of the people who destroyed the temple we had to restore, actually.
So that's the monster half, I ask.
Yes.
Timothy places his hands in his pockets.
My mother left me alone with my father, so I never learned what she knew. I've never even met her.
He takes a deep breath.
One day, I ran away from him and found the entrance to the Guardian Temple. The only thing that comes naturally is my ability to do this,
he said with an outstretched hand as a pair of doors appeared in the yard out of nowhere. I look, and inside, now well lit, is the room I was so used to working in but had no desire to visit again.
I used its gates to come to this world, joined the military, rose up the ranks, and gained influence. Because I'm going to fight my father.
He looks to me.
I'm going to stop him and his sister from destroying another world. To do that, I needed a base. I did my best alone, but I needed help to fix the temple up.
So you called me? Timothy nods again.
I didn't lie about how I heard of you. Everything else is settled.
How did you save my family? I thought they were dead. I saw bodies. Timothy laughs.
I got your message. When I did, I realized the mistake I made, that I didn't know where you were or that you had a family. But you should thank Chavez. He knew where your address was. From there, I was able to will the gates to open. I had just opened them in the basement and found your family there. Sandy's quite the smart woman, by the way. She had soaked towels and sheets and shoved them under the doors, windows, and was doing her best to hide under a soaked blanket. She
was shocked to see a pair of doors appear out of nowhere, but she ran in regardless, taking the kids. He sighed. From there, I was able to substitute some corpses, and Chavez and I figured out a way for you to defeat Belial.
I raise an eyebrow. Why couldn't you defeat him?
Timothy's smile weakened as he looked at my new house. I was afraid.
He kicks the dirt slightly, frustrated.
Belial manipulated my mother, stole her away from my grandmother, and nearly got his hands on something that could have handed him the world, all because of my miscalculations. He's older and more powerful than anything I'm likely to ever face or be. So, it's like you thought in the car. Your guardian angel is kind of,
He grins a bit at me.
Pussy.
Like I thought, I said, bewildered.
Mind reading is a simple trick if you're part angel, apparently.
Why me?
Honestly, Timothy said, some amusement in his voice. Belial, at his core, is a follower of Lucifer. Like his master, he's most vulnerable when he thinks he's won the day.
So me thinking he killed my family and him tormenting me was him, what, boasting?
Timothy nods. Pride comes before the fall, always.
I shake my head.
So I get why I helped, but you couldn't call in reinforcements for a thing like Belial?
Timothy's smile falls.
Fred, I am the reinforcements.
I felt my stomach fall a bit.
What do you mean?
Timothy looks to the temple entrance in front of us.
Angels existed on this plane because God needs them to perform his miracles. God, while omnipresent, is also omni-absent. The angels serve his desires and he directs them from time to time.
He looks to me.
Think of it as if every time God blinks, a few hundred years pass. He can only invoke his will directly from time to time when directly called upon by someone of extremely strong faith.
I look to the temple doors again.
So, that temple, the guardian temple, where God's angels amassed to coordinate his will, chose prophets, created miracles, led by the Metatron.
I recall the blood I had to clean up.
So wait, you mean... They're gone, murdered by what is in essence my aunt and father. I'm all that's left, and I'm trying to rebuild. So for now, we need to lean on the resolve and faith of mortals like you.
He smiled at me.
But now I don't feel so helpless. I feel like there's a chance, however small.
Timothy looks at the open gates with a faraway gaze.
We're losing, however. I'm not sure how long it's going to take me to recover and get the upper hand.
How long do you need? I ask, like I could do anything.
15, maybe 20 years. Which reminds me, I need to get back to work.
Timothy gives out a sudden whistle.
Chavez and I should go. We've caused you enough trouble.
Chavez? Still? I laugh. What do you need him for?
Timothy looks to my house again with a look of serenity as I see Chavez running out towards us with a plate with a slice of cake on it. To show me what I can hopefully become.
St. Timothy, I'm coming! Also, Mrs. Massillon made you a cake!
Chavez shouts. Timothy narrows his eyes. I swear, Chavez, if it's...
Angel food cake!
Chavez just smiles broadly at the pun. I groan as Chavez hands over the cake to Timothy, who is also rolling his eyes, and they walk towards the doors. Timothy stops before closing the doors and says, "If you need me again, you have my number." The doors close and vanish into thin air. "I hope I never see you again," I say out loud as I head into my new house. Epilogue. 10 years later, and I work in restoration. On the weekends, my new crew and I check out churches in need of repair, and free of charge, work on restoring their stonework.
We do it as charity. Nothing but the raw materials are paid for. Usually, the priest takes up a collection via the old-school plates, or we get it done by a crowdfunding website. My new guide, Devin, is on the second floor of this church overlooking the center aisle, checking out a stone pillar in bad shape. "Fred, this thing can't be secured. We're going to have to get some temporary supports for the roof and literally rebuild it from the ground up. Knock out the old, bring in a new one, whole nine yards." "Padre's not going to be happy," Devin shouts down. "He can pray for it to be fixed, but unless God sends mason angels, it ain't happening."
"Ask and ye shall receive." The priest of the church apparently overheard us, and he walks toward me. "Dare I ask? I'm sure that's expensive."
I nod. "I'll get a quote together for you and see what we can do, Father." He nods.
"And I'll call my insurance company after I pray to God to help me through the customer support robots."
Priests all have terrible jokes, by the way. Something you learn when working in multiple churches. My tinnitus kicks in, which I've had for the past 10 years. I wish it was the normal sort, where you hear a sort of high-pitched ringing. But it's not. It's a high-pitched scream. The sort I heard when Belial was cast out. I pull out some eardrops, which I keep in the same bottle Chavez gave me. The screaming stops pretty quickly. The priest looks at the bottle for a moment.
"St. Enoch? Obscure."
I laugh. "It was a gift from a friend of mine, Timothy." The priest nods.
"Ah, that makes sense that he's named Timothy."
I look to the priest oddly. "Why does it make sense?" The priest smiles at me.
"Well, my boy, Timothy means follower of God."
I smile and nod. "Yeah, that's him." One of the nuns runs up to us.
"Father, something's happening on the news in Jerusalem."
The priest turns and follows her. I follow out of my newfound curiosity. We all head into a back room with a television in it. Two other nuns are inside, glued to the TV. It looks like an overhead shot of destroyed streets, and the headline reads, "Terror in the Holy Land." I see a little I-24 logo in the corner. Never heard of the channel before, personally.
"I'm sure it's just hyperbole, sisters,"
the priest starts. The camera pans down to a group of 5 people. 3 of the group look like they're wearing a uniform of sorts. 2 are women, both blonde. The man is bald. They're wearing white, long sleeves with black vests and matching black pants. Another man is seen next to them, and it's hard to make out what he's wearing. It's red and brown and black, and I swear he could be wearing a cape or something. Short white hair on his head. The largest figure of the 5 looks like a massive man with long white hair braided down their left side, while the right side of their head seems to be shaved completely. The larger man wears what looks like white full-plate armor and a white cape with a blue accent inside of it. Suddenly, the bald guy cracks his fingers and fire spews forth from his hands like he has a flamethrower under each palm. One of the sisters watching screams, and the priest tries to comfort her. The anchorman on the TV feed chimes in.
"It looks like they have some kind of advanced weapon systems, and it seems attack helicopters are being called in..."
"Oh my God!"
The camera shakily changes as the white figure is suddenly in the air and a pair of white wings have unfolded from behind. In an instant, suddenly, something springs from the angel's back, lands in its hand, and smashes into the helicopter, destroying it in an explosion of fire before the figure flaps their wings again, blasting the debris away and diving at the next helicopter, jabbing the object that was pulled out into the helicopter closer to the camera. I lunge for the remote and hit the pause on the TV. Frozen on the screen, it's clearer to see it's not a man, but an absolute monster of a woman. In her hands is a massive sword, huge and bulky, and yet she seems to wield it without much effort. It looks like there's a blue Omega symbol on one of the shoulders of her white armor. I recall what happened to the helicopter as she swung at it, destroyed in a single blow. I remember the bloodstains of the temple as my hellish tinnitus kicks in again. I remember the gash in the floor as I spot the sword on the screen. Mike's voice echoing in my mind. This looks like one clean cut.
The voice of the woman who Timothy was talking to in the temple behind the barricade, and I remember what she said over the sound of machinery.
It was her, wasn't it? The daughter of Lucifer.
One of the nuns asks, Is that an angel? My face goes pale as I realize who this is, what she can do, what she has done. She's here now, the people Timothy is trying to stop. I try to fathom if Timothy has had enough time to get ready, if we have any hope at all. The priest suddenly starts to speak behind us all.
And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts, and I looked, and behold...
He points at the screen ominously, his hand shaking.
A pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and Hell followed with him.
You've been listening to Restoration Part 2 by Jordan Eilbert. Jordan Eilbert is a longtime sci-fi and horror enthusiast. He focuses on character-driven stories to create intricate worlds and leave readers wanting more. Along with his co-author, Mimi Jasso, he is also the author of the Guardian Temple series, with the most recent book, The Broken Throne of Heaven, having been released in March 2026. Can't a man go a mere decade without getting embroiled in a second religious calamity? I suspect it's just like any job. Once you prove your worth, now you're the one on the hook when new work comes up. In any case, our buddy Fred had a better ending than most of our protagonists here on Horror Hill. I suppose it fits in with springtime arriving and life flourishing and all of that banal nonsense. But rest assured, dear listener, not all of our heroes get a happy ever after, even if it only lasts 10 years. Next week, I think we'll have something a bit more grim. In the meantime, thanks to Jordan Eilbert for the story tonight, and of course, thanks to all of you listeners for joining me. Until next time, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot, and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.